So are you one of the kinds of people that the circumstances and things going on in life, you're just kind of wishing and hoping that a miracle is going to happen? Budget might be tight on a given month and you start having crazy thoughts. Oh, man, it'd be awesome if I just won the lottery and this problem would go away. Or wouldn't it be easy if just, that rich uncle that I don't even have passed away and felt bad for me and sent me all this whatever. Or, there's some job circumstance you think, man, if that person would just get transferred, it'd be awesome. Looking for some miracle, some radical thing to change. And, we hear these things that happen, and, I think sometimes it's easy for us to not focus on things that we should be focused on because we're looking for that one in a bazillion chance of something actually happening, which, by the way, statistically, you have a greater chance of becoming the president than you do winning the lottery. So I'm probably not going to try either bid anytime soon. When it comes to our entertainment-rich culture, a lot of times we see in stories or we see in movies or in television shows sensational things that happen in people's lives. And it's perhaps because of something that kind of came out of nowhere. And I think that tends to influence our thinking so that we say, well, God can do miracles too. And so sometimes we tend to view God as a, just bring a miracle my way kind of God, instead of the God who is working out His perfect plan in His perfect will, in His perfect time, through ordinary people living ordinary lives in ordinary circumstances. I think sometimes we've tended to think that we have to have some unusual thing happen instead of just doing what it is that God has called us to do. I'll take that call later, if you don't mind. No one's listened to a word I've said for the last 2 minutes, so might as well take the call. So let this serve as a warning to you. Turn off all cell... I think that happened to Paul Mangum once, didn't it? Oh, it did. Yeah, there he is. All right. That's great. First tip he told me, make sure you turn your cell phone off if you have it with you when you go into the pulpit. And there's another. Ordinary things of life, like cell phones going off at the most obscure times or unfortunate times, right? And we realize that, certainly God can do amazing things. God can work out unbelievable details. And I don't want to diminish from that at all. But what I want us to see and start to understand is that the normal way that God orchestrates His plan is through ordinary people doing their regular things day in and day out. It's the ordinary means of grace, we might say. And what we're going to begin studying starting this morning is looking at the life that happened through, an Israelite family that got merged in with a Moabite family, which those two should not have been together in any way, shape, or form, but yet that's how life worked and how God used those things purposefully and intentionally to accomplish His will. The book of Ruth, as we start to look at this, is going to show for us the faithfulness of God to accomplish His will through humanity in the ordinary things of life. You know what some of the big things are in the book of Ruth? I know many of you have read through this. The ordinary things that we see that God does to orchestrate His plan is through food, marriage, and children. Through everyday things. And so God is accomplishing His will as well as demonstrating His faithfulness through humanity in these regular things of life. So our God is faithful to use human agency, or humans, to accomplish His eternal will. We see the goodness of God and His faithfulness demonstrated through humanity in the book of Ruth. We're also going to see the direct faithfulness of God in provision, and particularly what some of us has referred to as dumb luck, Like, seriously, have you ever experienced something in life where the chances of two people meeting at such and such a time and at such and such a place seem impossible? And we sometimes say, man, that's amazing luck that a person has. But in this particular case, as we see in the Scripture, there's no such thing as luck. In fact, there's no such thing as luck anywhere in the Scriptures. But even from the human side of things, we see, wait a minute, that's just an unbelievable chance. I mean, literally, a chanced chance is how we could translate some of these connections that are made in the book of Ruth. It's fascinating that God is the one who is orchestrating these things through humanity. Overall, we'll see how God's plan of redemption cannot and will not be thwarted. It can't be changed. So while we see amazing things that are happening in the book of Ruth in terms of food, in terms of marriage, and in terms of children, the overarching theme that we don't want to miss is the overarching plan of redemption and how all of these circumstances fit into God's plan in an amazing way. So what we learn overall is that our faithful God will accomplish His plan of redemption to preserve a family line. And He does this with unexpected people in an unexpected place through unexpected circumstances. It's an amazing story of the challenges of life, dealing with famine, disobedience. We see other positive things and intrigue all throughout, love, romance, fear of the unknown, hardships. Redemption, thanksgiving, all of this owed to the faithfulness of our God. And what we see is His demonstration of His faithfulness toward His people, ultimately to bring about not just any family line, but the line of a king. Turn, if you would, to Ruth chapter 1. Because I want us this morning to kind of get an overarching picture and really just kind of introduce the book and the characters and see what's happening here as we take a look at what it is that is going on. Getting some background information, a little bit of history of what was going on at the time that this story took place as well as when it was written. And as we begin reading, I want us to see even this morning that believers are not exempt from the realities of hard changes in life as a part of God's plan. Believers are not exempt from the realities of hard changes in life as a part of God's plan. Ruth chapter 1, please follow along as I read the first 5 verses. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. And a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his 2 sons. The name of the man was Elimelech, the name of his wife Naomi, and the names of his 2 sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephratites from Bethlehem in Judah. They went to the country of Moab and remained there, but Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. She was left with her 2 sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah. The name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. And both Mahlon and Chilion died. So that the woman was left without her 2 sons and her husband. Will you pray with me as we take a look at the Scriptures this morning? Lord, I pray as we begin this study, taking a look at the book of Ruth, that You would give us a sense that You are not caught off guard by anything. That You would give us a sense that You are the one who is orchestrating Your perfect will, in Your perfect plan, in Your perfect timing, in Your perfect way, using imperfect people. God, I pray that You would help us to recognize that You are the faithful God who is above all, through all, and in us all who know You. And we pray these things in Your Son's name. Amen. Believers are not exempt from the realities of hard changes in life as a part of God's plan. You know, this is like a depressing way to start a story. Which on the one hand catches everyone's attention, because who wants to read about a story about something goes perfect for everyone, you know? You read a story, it's like, here's someone, they came into a bunch of money, and everything's going well for them. They married the perfect person, they have the perfect kids, and you're like, okay, yeah, that's great, whatever. But you hear about someone who's going through challenges or difficulty, and you're like, whoa, what's going to happen? How are they going to get out of this situation? So first, to a certain extent, these first couple of verses start to set up for us the characters in this story, this biblical narrative, as well as some of the challenges that they were going to be facing. So in verses 1 and 2, I want us to see that even for believers, life can often take unexpected turns. In these first two verses, we see the setting of the story, and the characters for us are laid out, some of which remain prominent, some of which are hardly known at all. First question we want to ask, though, when we look at these first couple of verses is, when was this story written? When was this story written? When was this account written? You see here, this opening line says, in the days when the judges ruled. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about when it actually happened. But it seems as if this is a story that was written a little bit later in Israel's history, where they're reflecting back, or the author of this particular narrative is reflecting back. It's almost like, remember way back when. Remember back in the days. So it's not something that has just happened, but rather it is something that the readers or the listeners would have understood in light of Israelite history. So it's not something that happened like right then. It's something that happened previously. And part of the reason for that is because of some of the other things that we see here that are pointed out about David in particular, that we're going to see in just a few moments. So the audience was certainly familiar with the era in which it was written, but it was something that was in the past. It's difficult to say exactly when this letter would have been composed or this narrative would have been written. Possibly sometime after the people of Israel had been exiled, perhaps just prior to the time where they were banished to away from their homeland. It's possible it was written around that time. Potentially, it was up to 500 years after the time this story took place. Perhaps it was a little bit sooner than that, maybe around the reign of Solomon, maybe around the reign of another king by the name Josiah. It's not real clear exactly when this happened, but what is clear is that the people who would have been hearing this or reading this or would have heard this would have understood this is something that happened in the past and it related to after the time of King David. Because they're going to see the line of what happened there. So when did the story take place? It took place during the period of the judges. Verse number one is rather clear. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So this judges period would have been about 1,000 years or so, maybe 1,200 years or so before the time of Christ. It was during this time, it was actually after Joshua's death. He had been leading the people of Israel. He died. You can read that in Judges 1 and verse 1. And it was the period of the judges consisted of that time period and the time that Saul became the first king, 1 Samuel 10. So you have this extended period of time, a few hundred years, where it was certainly an era in which there was a fair amount of chaos. You can read the end of Judges and realize that everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. It was a time of violent invasions. There was apostate religions going on everywhere, unchecked lawlessness, all kinds of tribal civil war between the clans of the Israelites even, and between the Israelites and others. All kinds of infighting and fighting without. In some sense, one might even say that the period of the judges threatened Israel's survival. All throughout Judges, you see calls for someone to bring about order for them and the call for a king. And it eventually happened. The judges were the ones who ruled primarily. It wasn't a national leadership, but rather like a localized kind of thing where it was much more militarily driven versus politically driven. And so it was basically warlords running things, which doesn't really result in people, you know, operating under any kind of good practice nationally. Everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. So it was during this period when things were chaotic. Things were not calm, politically or militarily or in any way. Things were kind of upsetting. It says that there was a famine in the land, and there was a particular man from Bethlehem. They were from the town of Bethlehem. The name Bethlehem means house of bread. It's ironic that famine happened in the city called the house of bread. And so the writer of this narrative is going to employ all kinds of irony, where he is going to see, or she, as the author could be, I suppose, the author of this particular story is going to write it in such a way so that we understand the amazing ironies that were happening in this person's life. Hi, I'm from the house of bread, and we have none. And so that's the situation that they were up against. Things were not looking good for them. There's a few other things that are very important in terms of understanding where they came from, because now you have this family that came out of Bethlehem of Judah, and then there's other connections in the letter, or in the book rather, that show the importance of where they came from and why that's significant. Look, if you would, at chapter 4, I'm going to read verses 11 and 12. Ruth 4, verses 11 and 12. These are some important literary markers of where they were from in the sense of understanding its connection to Israelite history. So it's not just random facts for throwing out random facts. They're all in there for a particular reason. So what we're going to see here in verses 11 and 12 is an explicit mentioning of Rachel, Leah, Perez, Judah, and Tamar. We're going to see some connections here. So in Ruth 4, verse 11, then all the people were at the gate, and the elders said, "We are witnesses. May the Lord make the woman who is coming into your house like Rachel and Leah, who together built up the house of Israel. May you act worthily in Ephratah and be renowned in Bethlehem. And may your house be like the house of Perez, whom Tamar bore to Judah, because of the offspring that the Lord will give you by this young woman." So now we have this connection of this family, this random family that happens to be out of Bethlehem. This random family from Bethlehem, so to speak, or seemingly random family from the house of bread, has no food, and so they go to this other place. After, of course, they go to the place, and I'm jumping around in the story a little bit here, but I think we're familiar enough with the narrative. They end up going back to Bethlehem eventually. And after a child is born to Ruth, she is put in the same category as other well-known matriarchs, if I can use that word, within the history of Israel. So it's important for us to understand that these literary markers are catching people's attention as they're reading the story. Because if we're reading this through the ears and the eyes of someone who grew up in Israel, so to speak, they would hear these things and say, "Whoa, that's a significant name. That's a significant town. And here's the reason why. Because of where they came from." Ruth is to be a founding mother like Jacob's wives, who, along with these other women, gave birth to Israel's 12 tribes. I'd say that's a significant list of people to be connected to. And so Ruth is then also put into Boaz's house, and Boaz's house is equal to that of Perez, Judah's revered tribal ancestor, if I can put it in those terms. This is like the big list of the who's who in Israelite history. And here's this family of who knows who from Bethlehem getting connected with some lady from a foreign country who doesn't even belong in the covenant people of Israel. All these big markers are laid out for us here. We see one last connection here at the end of chapter 4. You're in there. Look it down in verse 18. Now these are the generations of Perez. Perez fathered Hezron. Hezron fathered Ram. Ram fathered Amminadab. Amminadab fathered Nashon. Nashon fathered Salmon. Salmon fathered Boaz. Boaz fathered Obed. Obed fathered Jesse. And Jesse fathered David. It's an unusual kind of epilogue to a story, isn't it? By the way, here's a bunch of people who were born. Of course, we read this just like Israel read it, and they would have seen and heard and understood the significance of who David is and the promise given to David. That's why this was written sometime after the time of the Judges, after the time of David, and it's very likely that they're looking back and seeing the amazing way that God preserved the line of David during an era that everyone knew was terrible. What's even more profound is they're looking back at these things and they're saying, how is it possible that anyone could have survived that famine, worked through these incredible circumstances to orchestrate things, to come along to find this lady who was going to get married to this guy, to get connected to this family, and then back around to Bethlehem? It's just an unbelievable set of circumstances. And what's interesting as we go through this narrative, it's not going to look like something that looks like a happy occasion. I mean, they're looking back at history. We always look at history, by the way, with rose-colored glasses. You know, we look back as if everything was perfect because look at the result. Look at what happened. But make no mistake, this is difficult stuff. So we're going to spend a little bit of time thinking through the connections that are there for Israelite history as well as the reality of what this particular woman faced. We see that this family left Bethlehem because there was a famine in the land. What caused it? I don't know. Which famine? I don't know. Text doesn't tell us. Famines came as all kinds of different reasons throughout. You can read this in Amos 4, 1 Kings 1, 2 Kings 7. Famines came for all kinds of different reasons. Drought, disease, locust invasions, loss of livestock, even warfare. Seemed to be a localized famine, though, because they went from one side of the Dead Sea, for those of you who are familiar with the geography, and they traveled maybe 5 to 7 days, maybe a little bit longer, to the other side of the Dead Sea, to Moab. So it wasn't like an entire area was all wiped out with food. It seemed to be a localized one to Israel, or to Judah specifically. The phrase, though, that's used here again, famine in the land, is a fascinating one because it's only used two other times in the Old Testament. This ought to catch our attention when we're studying the Scriptures. Because if an author employs something, particularly from the book of Genesis, and brings it to bear now, written centuries later, it ought to catch our attention as to what he's referring. Because again, this is another one of those literary markers, something that someone's hearing a story, and you're hearing little pieces of information along the way. And all of a sudden, here's another key piece. You're saying, whoa, 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 wait a minute. A famine in the land, it certainly recalls the biblical pattern that advanced God's plan for his people and would have been something that would have been well understood by the people in Israel. In this particular case, we see the survival of this man Elimelech and his heritage. Of course, we know it's not just for a particular dynasty. Because as he employs this idea of, the author employs the idea of the famine in the land, it only appears in Genesis 12 and in Genesis 26. It's a reference to the call of Abraham and how there was a famine in the land and he went to Egypt. Again, impossible circumstances with Father Abraham that worked out beneficially for the people of Israel. So in their minds, they said, okay, wait a minute, this is another indication. This is Bethlehem. That's a key thing. There's a famine in the land. Boy, this sounds a lot like something that may have happened to one of our other patriarchs. Apparently, there's something very significant that's going to be going on here. So these things start to get laid out for the listener. Throughout the entire narrative as well, there's other sections which seem to carry over. And the list is pretty amazing. Of some of the comparisons. I'm not going to highlight all of them. I'm just going to highlight a couple of them. One of them is the migration that I just mentioned of famine, which actually advances God's plan. You have what's going on here in Ruth 1 and verse 1. Compare that with Genesis chapter 12. And it seems like, okay, God, what's going on here? You sent a famine? But wait a minute. Don't be deceived by hearing the word famine, because we remember that happened to Abraham once, and that actually advanced God's plan. Another case, and we're going to see this, we already read it in verse number 5, a family's survival is endangered because of a mother's childlessness. We remember this throughout Genesis 16 and 17. I'm going to highlight one other key phrase that's in here, pointing back to that time in Genesis 16. We see a foreigner's voluntary permanent immigration to a new land for the sake of following Yahweh, the sake of following Jehovah, the sake of following the God of Israel. It's exactly what Ruth did, and we're going to see that as we go through that. Needless to say, there's a few other ones that, Lord willing, as we continue our study, we'll see those things pointing back to the rest of Israelite history. So where did they go? Where did they go? It says that they went on to this place called Moab. So going from Israel, from Judah, from Bethlehem, going to Moab, was this an act of faith or an act of disobedience? Because it's possible that famine came on the people of Israel because of disobedience. So was there some, you know, I mean, literally, was there some kind of sin in the camp that caused this famine, and Elimelech was like, I'm not dealing with this, I'm taking my family out of here? We don't know. We don't know the details of that. It seems as if this was some level of an act of faith, because why would the writer draw the same parallel from Genesis 12? Excuse me, 12. In other words, it seems as if this man was following God and was following the leading of God to go into a foreign land. So he goes on to this place. The town of Moab, or the city, the area of Moab, is defined as or understood as the provider of seed. The provider of seed. That's what Moab means. Moab, like I mentioned, is located on the opposite side of the Dead Sea from where their foreign enemy Israel and Judah existed. You know, so for this family to go from Israel, from Judah, to Moab is not like us, you know, oh man, we're out of jobs, you know, we're out of food. Let's go to Canada because they have, the logging industry is doing well, so we're going to go to Canada. Like in our minds, we think, you know, they're our friends of the north, sure. We'll go up to Canada. That's not like what this was like for them at all. This would be more like when I was a kid, the idea of even going to Russia was like, no way, they're our arch enemy. I mean, the Cold War, some of you may or may not remember some of this. You know, Ronald Reagan could do no wrong from the 80s because of the Cold War and how he stood against a tyrant in our, you know, in our world. So in this case, this was more like a huge deal. And honestly, one that you need to understand in terms of how an Israelite would have viewed the Moabites. This was no small step. The move to Moab must be interpreted in light of the general Israelite disposition toward them. First of all, the Moabites began out of an incestuous relationship between Lot and his daughter, Genesis 19. That's a great way to start a new people. Yeah, not going to win any awards for that. So it started off with things extremely shady. There was resistance to Israelite passage through their territory when they came from Egypt. Numbers 22 through 24. There was other cases where Moabite women had seduced Israel, the Israelites, and it created all kinds of punishment for the people of Israel. Numbers 25. That's not winning any historical awards for the people of Israel. Israel's exclusion of Moab was seen in their assembling when they gathered together before the Lord's name in Deuteronomy 23. So it was like, we are basically excluding them because they are our enemy, as declared in Deuteronomy. There was also some relatively recent oppression at the time that this story would have taken place. Some oppression of the Israelites by Eglon, who was the king of Moab, Judges chapter 3. Seems like this had already just occurred. And so now you have these people who are the archenemies of the people from Bethlehem and saying, hey, you know what, we're kind of hungry. Let's head over there. What? This doesn't even add up from like a country standpoint. Don't you love America, right? Don't you love Israel? What are you doing? And he's going on to this place. I wonder if this was some of the same thoughts that we see and how we would have responded if we were Jonah. Hey, go to the Ninevites. They'll be your friend. With that same kind of, but obviously the need was much greater for survival. So, the people of Moab, we can safely say, were not readily accepted into Israelite history. So who are these people then that left apparently by faith to go and take care of their family? Who is this man Elimelech? His name literally means my God is king or God is king. Naomi's name means my pleasant one or pleasant or to be pleasant. Just interesting facts about who these people are. Their sons, the etymology of their names is not real clear. It could mean to be complete. Could mean at an end. All kinds of different guesses, but the only interesting aspect, really, not only, but one of the interesting aspects with Elimelech's name is here's a man whose name means God is king, and he's having to flee his own land where God is king. One could ask, where's God in all this, right? So as we reflect on what's going on in these first couple of verses, setting the stage for this powerful story about what's going on, let's think of this from the perspective as if we are Israelites. We say, hey, look, God's promised that he's never going to leave us or forsake us, right? So, but now we have no food. So clearly God is going to take care of us, and this family is following the leading of the Lord, apparently, and sending them and taking their family on to this place in Moab, which is a less than ideal solution to their serious dilemma. So the challenge for us, even as we read about these circumstances and what's going on, is that sometimes we want to live our lives just like we read this story. Here's what I mean by that. We read these couple opening remarks. We hear about these people dying. We're like, yeah, that's sad. Too bad. But we all know it works out in the end because David becomes, you know, is born. And we want our lives to be lived as if we are reading a narrative like this. We say, you know, there's circumstances that are going on right now. God, can't you just tell me the end from the beginning so that I know exactly what's going on and what's going to happen? But let's think for a moment of how God was orchestrating these details in these people's lives. And let us learn by their example of having the trust and the faith to follow God who promises that he will be faithful. Now we know that he will be, but in the midst of these things, it is difficult for us as believers because sometimes we think we're just exempt from those realities. When instead we live in a sin-cursed world. So we have this circumstance in the first two verses that life can often take unexpected turns. Then in verses 3 through 5, we see that even for believers, God's plan may include unexpected difficulties. And I want us to see in these few verses, I'm going to read them again in just a moment, the ups and downs, in fact, the amazing highs and lows in life that can exist in the midst of God fulfilling his plan in our lives. Amazing highs and lows. Look at verses 3 through 5. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died. She was left with the two sons. These took Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah. The name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years. So here we go from no food to finding food. We're going to see death and marriage all in the span of, you know, just a few words. So obviously the author wants to just kind of cut to the chase and get us moving into other parts of the story to accomplish the goal of understanding God's faithfulness throughout Israelite history. But particularly here, they went to Moab with the hope for food. You know, the story is not very sympathetic. I mean, did you ever think about that? All right, they went there and they died. Next point. No explanation, no understanding, no details, no cause. Why was he dead? Was there an accident? Was God chasing him? It's just ironic that a man's name that means God is king dies first. Shifts to her sons. They were left alive. Naomi's name starts to shift now in its meaning because what went from pleasant is now not so pleasant. She's faced with those difficulties. Her difficulty only bred more difficulty. Death, and then no children, and then death again. These two men, her two sons, married into the Moab world. Marriage, of course, was expected to be joyous, but how do you think this marriage would have been viewed by some of their friends and family, or even people in Moab themselves? I don't think it was viewed as a very positive thing. You know, it's interesting how we talk about not being racists until we're faced with the difficulty of bringing the gospel or bringing our lives or living Christianity in the midst of people who hate it. Not just hate it, but hate you. And so it's easy for us to not use that word and just say, well, you know, that's just too challenging of a circumstance or whatever else, or we excuse it. But my question is, even as I read these things, how were these things viewed within their own world? Fascinating. And yet we read by these things without really thinking of the perspective of how it might have gone. I mean, was this a violation of the law? Deuteronomy 7 verses 3 through 4 certainly give us the indication that was in the spirit of the law. Moabites were not specifically listed as someone you cannot marry, but certainly those who were opposed to God was listed. So it seems like they were violating the law. Not a direct violation, but man, it really runs close. Really runs close to violating the law. I mean, were they far enough away from Judah that it wouldn't have been a problem? I mean, you know, they're outside the radius of where God's law applied. I mean, that doesn't make sense. Should Naomi have forbid these marriages from happening? Does she encourage them? We don't know. We don't know any of these details. We just know that this is what happened next. Were some of these things a reality of the fulfillment of covenant curses because her sons died? I mean, what was going through her mind? Hi, let me take my kids here. Now I'm going to let them marry into this culture, and now they're both dead. Was she thinking, God just judged me? It's significant to note here that before her sons died, that Naomi lived with, they all lived there, and her sons were in this married state for 10 years, but without fathering any children. It's a significant fact that he includes here. No children for a widow, because remember, her husband's dead at this point. No children for a widow in this particular time in history is something that was extremely significant. It was viewed as something that was a loss, that her life would be an absolute waste without an heir, and that she was basically useless now as a human in the culture and in the world. So it says that they went to sojourn there, they remained there, and then verse number 4, they actually lived there. It seemed like they were more settled in Moab. This 10-year span, though, only heightens the tension that's happening. Remember, we're reading this as if we're Israelites. Turn, if you would, to Genesis 16. Because in Naomi's mind, she is from Bethlehem, right? And in the Israelite reader's mind, here's this lady from Bethlehem. They understand that ultimately this is going to produce the line of David, but now she has no sons and she has no children. So it's possible that the Israelite reader didn't know all of the details about all of what happened with Naomi and Ruth and Boaz and the whole nine yards, and now they're getting the rest of the story. It's like someone's filling in the gap of all of what happened. And so there's this 10-year period now, and they're saying, wait a minute, Naomi is connected to Ruth, and Ruth is the one who's in this genealogy that we all know of, that we've had to memorize with every other catechism. So what is going on? How can this even occur? What's going to happen next? Genesis 16 offers some insight for us into Israelite culture and the tension that would have been built in the reader's mind that was obviously still present at the time that this was written and the time that it occurred. Genesis 16, please follow along as I read, starting verse number 1. Now Sarai, Abraham's wife, had borne him no children. She had a female Egyptian servant whose name was Hagar. Sarah said to Abram, behold now, the Lord has prevented me from bearing children. Go into my servant, that it may be that I shall obtain children by her. And Abraham listened to the voice of Sarah. So Abraham had lived 10 years in the land of Canaan. There's a 10-year span. And finally, Sarah says, look, this is not working. We need children. God promised it. We have to make it happen. It's not happening, so let's come up with plan B. It seems as if 10 years was the customary period, giving a couple time to produce children on their own before taking alternative steps. So the reference here to 10 years heightens the tension. Will the marriages be able to preserve a line in the midst of the tragedies that Naomi has experienced? Her husband's dead. They're now living in a foreign land. They take these people for their wives. What's going to happen next? Is infertility now a new reality? Are they going to need to take the Hagar route? But what do you think was going through Naomi's mind? Now there's no hope for children because both of the sons die. Why do they die? Who knows? Judgment, disease, don't know. Apparently, there's no hope for Naomi now. The ironic hardship is astounding that they're living in the place of Moab, which means provider of seed, and now she has none. And it seems as if things have gone the wrong direction. God is king is dead. There's no children for the people from Bethlehem. This is an important aspect in the history of Israel. We're not just talking here about any old person. We're talking about David. So as a widow now, she lacks the provision and the protection that is necessary in a male-dominated ancient society. Just the way it was. The situation looked truly hopeless. It's likely that given her age now at this point, she had no parents to go back to as a widow. Remarriage really seemed an impossibility or improbability at a minimum because it seems as if she was beyond childbearing years. She can't support herself by some trade. Women just did not go into the workforce. It just wasn't happening. So here she is in a very similar vein as we read in Genesis 30, in verse 1, where Rachel cried for children. Do you get the sense of the depth of despair with which this woman was living? How can I trust a faithful God? He's taken away our food. He's taken away my kids. And now the only thing I have are these two foreign wives that my son's married for whatever reason. The sense of hopelessness that had to have been present, which we see later as she even doesn't want to be referred to as pleasant anymore. Naomi now sits childless in a foreign land with no family, nowhere to go. This is certainly a dark way to start a story. I mean, this is not like happy days are sort of not here at all. Because we're left with the reality of what has happened in these people's lives. And as believers, we certainly need to understand that we are not exempt from the realities of hard changes in life as a part of God's plan. And sometimes things shift and alter. And sometimes we don't even know why. Like when we read this text, we don't know why. God obviously knows that we don't need to know why. But he's working out his perfect plan. which we understand what that involves in this particular case, but sometimes we want that thing to be true in our own lives. Why has this circumstance befallen me? Why have I faced this reality? Where's God in all this? It seems as if He is dead. And so here you have now this reality of trying to face and understand the faithfulness of God. And why is it so key for us to understand and know this text? Why is it so key for us to understand what is going on in the life of Ruth? Is it just about what is going on in the life of Naomi and Ruth? Is it just to understand that, you know, hopefully in the end, you'll end up with a grandchild? That may be true, it may not be true. Is the point to understand that we ought to avoid going to traveling to foreign countries? No, of course not. The whole point is for us to understand that God is working out all these details which we're going to see, and He's highlighting from past history what He has already done. Do you remember another situation where things did not go well for a particular leader in Israel, and yet through that famine and through that difficulty and through that circumstances, the entire nation was fed? The book of Genesis is replete with amazing acts of God's sovereignty with people who don't like God's people. Because the story of Joseph is an amazing one. How he took care of his people even in the midst of famine. And here's another one of these reminders about how we're going to see God's faithfulness played out. Famine. Moving to a scary situation, death, new family situations, all of these things can be very difficult for believers to get their head around at times. And certainly as we understand that God is orchestrating and working out all these plans according to His sovereign will, we must absolutely rest in His faithfulness to do what He says He was going to do. He is going to both to will and to work His good pleasure. We may not think that God is at work. It may seem as if He is not, but He is working. We see this story of Ruth being taken out of Bethlehem as a very significant one because we're going to see this movement from famine to incredible fruitfulness. Bethlehem is the burial place of Jacob's beloved Rachel. Bethlehem is where Obed, the son of Jesse, and his son David would also be born. The significance of understanding how God orchestrated these details through these people's lives and seeing the importance of even Bethlehem, Micah would prophesy later, but you, O Bethlehem Ephratah, who are too little to be among the clans of Judah, from you shall come forth for me one who is to be ruler in Israel, whose coming forth is from old, from ancient days, 300 years later or more, hundreds of years later. When Herod was asked after the time of Micah, when Herod was asked where the Messiah would be born, the passage from Micah was quoted in Matthew chapter 2. God's plan became more fully seen throughout time, that all of what He was doing came out of this little town called Bethlehem, going all the way back to the time of Ruth, back to the time when the judges ruled. This plan became a little more developed in the Roman Empire specifically when there was a census that was called for. If you remember this, right? People were sent back to their hometowns. And so Joseph was sent back to his hometown. Came from northern Israel all the way back down to Bethlehem. Ruth only appears in the New Testament in Matthew chapter 1 in the genealogy of Christ. There's the story of a preparation of a king, not just for Israel, but for all nations. And Ruth is brought to bear, a Moabite woman, the least likely candidate to be put into the scriptures. Only two books in the Bible are even named after women, and she's a non-Jew. It's astounding to see the way God uses people to accomplish His will. And so in the book of Matthew, we begin with Jesus' birth as the son of David and the son of Abraham, listing in there as well this particular woman, Ruth. Matthew ends then with the authoritative charge of Jesus to make disciples of all nations. So you have here the promise of this king, the fulfillment of the king, and then the commission of the king, all of which is driven from God's faithful plan. The critical story from the book of Ruth is not so much the provision of food, although it is that. It's not so much of a kinsman redeemer for Ruth, although it is that. It is primarily to preserve and for us to see the preservation of the plan of God to bring about the fullness of times for our great Redeemer, Christ. Believers are certainly not exempt from the realities of hard changes as part of God's plan. And we must all take comfort in knowing that God is the one who is orchestrating all things according to his perfect will, that we might see a full demonstration, even in the midst of difficulty, of our faithful God. Let's close with a word of prayer. Lord, I pray that you would help us to understand the amazing truths from your word and the work that you are doing as we understand historically how you have accomplished your plan for your glory. Lord, I pray that you would give us an appreciation for and a love for your word to see how these things that happen are not accidental, but are intentional to bring about your perfect will. Lord, I pray that you would help us to look to you and your faithfulness. And we pray these things in your Son's name. Amen.